Triple Divide fracking documentary will be showing at the First Unitarian Church in the Elliott Chapel, located at Southwest 12th and Salmon Street in Portland. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
We have a community reminder for you. The 2014 Justice Begins with Seeds Conference is happening tomorrow, Friday, and Saturday. This is a chance to hear some of the most important non-GMO advocates in the nation and the world. The event hopes to build momentum for the Oregon Mandatory Labeling of GMOs initiative, Measure 92, which will be on the November ballot. The event is tomorrow and Saturday at the First Congressional Church at 1126 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. We have free passes to the event at KBOO at our front desk. Come in today before 7 p.m. or tomorrow between 9 and 5 to get a free pass. Once again, that is the 2014 Justice Begins with Seeds Conference happening tomorrow and Saturday. It's time now for Between the Covers.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Imagine a world where an American city shuts off water to tens of thousands of its poorest residents, primarily people of color, while golf courses and corporations with long-standing delinquent water bills continue to receive water as normal. Or imagine a world where 40% of America were experiencing a drought so bad that the trillions of gallons of water depleted from the water table had caused the earth to actually rise in elevation. Or imagine a world where companies declare water the next oil rush, scrambling to privatize it, to own it, and profit from selling it back to people. Unfortunately, this is not a dystopian science fictional picture of the future, but the sober reality of life today. But when our guest, Ben Parzibach, began writing his latest novel, Sherwood Nation, he had imagined such a world before any of this had yet occurred. Ben Parzibach's first novel, Couch, a literary travelogue and fantastical quest, was an indie next pick. It has been compared to Douglas Adams by Publishers Weekly, Donald Barthelme, Jonathan Lethem, and Umberto Eco by Barnes & Noble, and to J.R.R. Tolkien by The Stranger. Parzibach is the founder of Walker Tracker, a pedometer-based step tracking website for individuals and organizations. He's also the co-founder and editor of Gumball Poetry, a literary journal that published poems in gumball machines, and the creator of the Black Magic Insurance Agency, a citywide scavenger hunt and alternate reality game. And he's here today on Between the Covers to talk about his much-anticipated and timely new novel, Sherwood Nation. Welcome to Between the Covers, Ben Parzibach.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here.
So Sherwood Nation takes place in a near future Portland that's trying to hold itself together amidst a protracted drought that has seized the western half of the United States. So tell us a little bit more about the world we enter on page one. What is going on in the country as a whole, and then what is going on in Portland more particularly?
Yeah, exactly. So I was particularly intrigued by what happens in a sort of collapse period. And this is I think of it as very much contrary to apocalyptic novels. But something like, for example, an analogy I often use is the Roman Empire collapses. And really, Rome is essentially destroyed in a day or two. But it's only over the next 100 years that the far reaches of that empire begin to feel that pullback, when legionnaires' salaries dry up, when the stone architects emigrate somewhere else, when there's no longer a system of security and food supply and trade routes dry up. And what happens during that period? And I think it's a really intriguing period, because there is a chance for a community to reinvent itself. When the yoke of the far-off father nation or mother nation disappears, then a community can rise up and invent itself. And so I was really playing with that idea in this book. And so in the middle of this book, really there's sort of what affects to a weather collapse, a climate collapse in the western half of the U.S. The eastern half of the U.S. is experiencing different difficulties having to do with political infighting and ongoing wars. And it's sort of in the middle of this almost city-state structure in Portland, Oregon. The book takes place in Portland, Oregon, where the book begins.
And in a way, there's sort of a mirroring between Portland and the country as a whole, because we have the West of the United States has sort of been left to its own devices. It's getting help from the East. It's getting shipments of water and intermittent services, but it's not functioning like the East is. And similarly, there's a part of Portland that still has city government as we know it, sort of. And then another part of Portland that has been sort of left to its own devices.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So just like in any city, there is different levels of city services. You know, I mean, you're aware of the speed bumps always appear first in the wealthy neighborhoods, and then the far out reaches of the city. There's a large disparity in city services, and that's exactly what's happening here. As the police force diminishes, as city services diminish, and there's less financing for city services, there's all kinds of imbalance within the city itself, even though there's still a government operating, and they're doing their best to kind of try to hold it together.
One of the things that I really love about the book is that it's exploring a slow catastrophe. So in contrast to an earthquake, a nuclear disaster, a hurricane, this is something that's happening gradually over time. And when we hear of people who or cities that go through big catastrophes, say like an earthquake in San Francisco, for instance, we often hear of people coming together and helping each other. And I wonder, to me, it feels like in Sherwood Nation, we see the effect of a slow catastrophe as being one that sort of is tearing the community apart, it seems. At the beginning, we have a man who's killed his dog so as not to have to share part of his rations. And there's this sense of the potential, if not all, the already present reality of people possibly turning against each other. Is that something that you thought about, the difference in how humans might respond to something that eats at you every day without an ending in sight versus something that is sudden and horrible that people might come together and put aside their differences around?
Yeah, I found this particularly intriguing to play with. With sudden disasters, it's really easy to rally support in a lot of ways. Like everybody is facing the same equalizing sort of catastrophe. People all chip in, and there's not this sense of a real slow cooker. And that slow cooker, you know, that I think it's the original analogy is the frog placed in cold water on a burner does not even realize it's boiling until it's too late. And this sort of scenario where, you know, despair deepens over time, people begin to do kind of odd and erratic things. I mean, one of my favorite characters spends most of the book digging a tunnel underneath his house. And I found that fascinating because it's a completely improper response to the disaster at hand. But yeah, I think that in these kinds of cases, and also because of the slowness of it, which humans have trouble with this kind of stuff as well. I mean, we don't really understand climate change because it happens on a timescale outside of us. We don't understand types of diseases and things like that and the spreads of diseases because it happens on a timescale outside of us, or erosion or environmental changes. So it was fascinating to play with, but I also feel like it begins to get some sort of interesting magnification because of news cycles and this continual grind.
Well, how wedded did you feel to doing research versus just imagining the world? Did you find yourself compelled to go and consult experts in either climate change or droughts or even other historical events similar to this? Or did you feel free to just picture what you thought it would be like?
Yeah, I love that question of research, really. My research style tends to be to write it and then go to see how wrong I was in the end. I went and talked to several hydrologists after the fact who have essentially assured me that this type of drought, the severity of this type of drought, couldn't happen in the Pacific Northwest, excepting something like a supervolcano in Yellowstone Park. But that's not what matters to me, really. It's really the sociological play, the implications of how a community reacts, the chance to explore different types of heroism, both the rise and a fall, and the media sort of echo of that within that kind of situation. I did look a lot at warlordism because I found it really fascinating. That it's really easy to demonize a warlord, but in a lot of these cases where there's warlords, there is a power vacuum, and they provide a certain set of social services as well, which is very odd, you know, to varying degrees, of course. I did a tour of the favelas in Rio de Janeiro, and that was super intriguing. I mean, basically, they are enclaves. They are nations within the city themselves that are a sort of anarchy, but within that anarchy, of course, community organizations rise up. They develop their own laws. They work to secure resources. And it was a chance for a community sort of cut off from the outside to completely reinvent itself. And it was great. So yes, I did do some research.
We're talking today to Ben Parzabak about his second novel, Sherwood Nation. You're listening to Between the Covers. Well, speaking of the upside of warlords, let's introduce the heart of the character who's sort of the heart of the story, Sherwood Nation, Renee, who's a barista in Portland, and gets thrust unwittingly into an entirely new reality for her. So tell us a little bit about what happens to her and how she becomes something more than Renee in Sherwood Nation.
Yeah, absolutely. So without spoiling too much, Renee is she comes from an activist background. Her parents were activists, so she has roots in it. She has deep ties to it, and it so happens during an activist, really one of her first major actions in the city as a water activist. How she sees herself is completely transformed by media's interpretation of her action. Essentially, they film her doing one thing over and over, and they play that over and over, which creates a folk hero of her. And the city is, and then of course the law comes in. There's a manhunt for her, and that really cements her reputation within the city. And so she's on the run at first, and as she continually parses that out within herself to try to figure out who she is post these events, she begins to up her own game. She begins to really understand who she wants to be and what she wants to do. And in the end, it leads her to gathering a force together and seceding a section of the city.
And when you say she's a water activist, I hope this isn't a spoiler, but she's a water activist because they've discovered that people have, that the distribution of water isn't fair and equitable in Portland.
Yeah, that's right.
That there is graft happening and parts of the city are getting illegal and undisclosed water.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they deem her Maid Marian, sort of Robin Hood fame because of that, because really her actions were a sort of steal from the rich and give to the poor, and that immediately becomes sort of a copycat crime, and that's made her famous within the city.
Well, one thing that's really cool about the sections that are around Maid Marian trying to figure out how am I going to create a new society, because she's in the part of the city that due to limitations of resources, the government is sort of just abandoned. It really does sort of evoke the DIY ethos of Portland, the way she's gathering together the strengths of her neighbors and trying to figure out how things go. But as you said, around the upsides and downsides of warlords, even though she's good intentioned, she's creating, in a sense, a large cooperative. She's also at the same time having to be, perhaps by necessity, a benevolent dictator of sorts. So there's that tension between this sort of utopian desire and then the true limitations that come when you're facing real things. Like what are you going to do about crime? How are you going to get services? Can you talk a little bit about some of the challenges that Sherwood Nation faced immediately upon its birth?
Yeah, so And it's interesting that you use the term benevolent dictator, that the word dictator is to bring back the Roman Empire. It was a person elected by the Senate to handle the nation in times of crises. And it doesn't have those negative connotations that we assign to it today. And I was really playing with this idea of democracy and how well does democracy respond to states of emergency. And so I did have René as a dictator. And of course, that has some downsides and some upsides, of course. There is not a community vote there, though I made this sort of an altered sort of state where there is a lot of community input and there is a lot of cooperative action in there. But she still has sort of an iron fist here where she needs to make a call. And if there is a crime that she can't figure out, then a person is just ejected from the nation back into the surrounds of the city. But yeah, there is, I mean, first of all, in a situation like that with such incredibly scarce resources and on the tail of chaos and riots, security was her first concern, and second was taking care of those citizens, securing water resources and making sure that people had the means to survive.
Well, one of the more fun parts of the book is watching René become Maid Marian and how she navigates her relationship with her boyfriend, because her boyfriend stays behind in Portland proper, and he's an ad man, and he creates slogans often for the benefit of the city. So in a weird way, he's creating propaganda for the person that his girlfriend's opposing, but he's also starting to not recognize his girlfriend within this new figure, Maid Marian, as she has to make these tough decisions, some of which not everyone understands, perhaps. They're having to navigate not only a long-distance relationship, but potentially a metamorphosis.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's an incredible transformation that happens within René. I love this idea of a long-distance relationship, but really it was. It's across international boundaries, right? But really, there's about 4 miles that separates them between the city proper and the nation of Sherwood within the book. And what you also are mentioning here is that Zach, René's boyfriend, works for the mayor, and we spent a lot of time in the mayor's viewpoint. Who is a mayor that I think in times of prosperity the city would love? He's an idealistic mayor, but in terms of his being able to handle this kind of crisis, it's very difficult.
And he must have been, I would imagine, a really fun character to write, because he is losing grip of what limited power he has, and tends to make the worst decisions in these moments of powerlessness.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, he turns to things where he does have some sense of control, and he's a bit of a video game addict. He's got his own generator, of course, as part of Portland's due to run the mayor's office. And yeah, so he exercises control over what he can control, but he is losing control over a lot.
I was curious about how it felt to write a book, Sherwood Nation, that is so rooted in place and so place-based, when your first novel, Couch, was both more overtly fantastical, but was also more more obviously a quest-based narrative. I would love to hear what challenges or upsides you saw to holding people within a situation like the drought in Portland versus writing the quest of Couch that took your characters freewheeling around the world.
First, I mean, I have to admit I live in Portland, and it's a joy to write about this city. I love this city, and I was not born here, but I have adopted this city, and it is with special pleasure that I call out landmarks in the book, even as I destroy them and do terrible things to them or create riots in the streets. It comes from a sort of love of this place. And so it almost feels obvious to me that I would want to write stories that put all my characters in here, that put us all in here living alongside other things. And I also derive special joy from thinking of people, of readers who might pass a water tower, for example, as there's several very significant scenes with water towers, or pass some of the landmarks in the city. So I love to do that. In fact, I've been thinking about my next book, and it will also be in Oregon. So it's one of the special pleasures of writing.
Well, even though, like, on the surface, the two books seem really different in sensibility, I think that there's some things that are very similar in the sense that they both put pressure on the characters to be inventive and also to reinvent themselves. It feels like in Couch, you have the constraint of the magical couch and what it's forcing them to do. And here we have the drought, even though they're both one group of characters is able to move and the other isn't. Ultimately, there's a way in which the narrative is forcing them to have to truly rely on some survival resources. And it made me think of your other projects, like Gumball Poetry with Can We Look at Poetry in a Different Way? Or the Operation Peach Blow, The Scavenger Hunt, which is sort of a way of telling narrative in real time in the city itself. Do you see that connection between the books and between your interests in general around this, demanding a certain savviness of your characters to problem solve?
Yes. What an interesting question. I certainly see a connection between the books, and I do hope readers do too. I realize that to some it may seem like I've migrated from a book that was essentially a very humorous book to one that seems very dark. But I find a lot of this book very funny as well. And I really hope readers do too, even though it's like these very oppressive themes and there's riots happening in the book and dictators and stuff like that. But there was parts of it that I love. So I do see that kind of continuity in the book. And another thing you mentioned is constraints. And I think you and I have talked about constraints before. I know that you really enjoy constraints, and I find constraints totally fascinating. The idea of having these three boys who cannot put down a couch was sort of an amazing constraint to work with in Couch. And in this kind of case where you are creating a fictional universe on top of a real city, but in a completely altered condition, was another kind of wonderful constraint.
We're talking today to Ben Parzebach about his second novel, Sherwood Nation. You're listening to Between the Covers. You'd mentioned earlier, I mean, we're talking about humorous. One of the things I thought was humorous were some of the ad agency slogans that were made. But what was kind of doubly funny was that the one that you mentioned earlier, that which is measured improves. When I went to your Walker Tracker website for your business, it's not only a slogan that you use in your business, but it's actually a real slogan from somebody else. So you didn't make that up. But I want to know about that slogan. What does that slogan mean to the book? And to you in general.
Yeah, I don't know. That slogan resonates with me very strongly. And I think it's that I'm so aware of living in a subjective universe and a subjective take on reality that any kind of measurement of real things I find so fascinating and vital. And I think that's what really drew me to pedometers. This is like my whole other personality here. But this whole idea that there is something that has always felt very subjective, this amount of movement in a day, that suddenly there's a device that measures that, is fascinating. And of course, now we're suddenly, I started that years ago, and now we're suddenly in this age of quantifying everything, which is a little scary in itself. But I do very much like that. I set that as a goal for myself in terms of many things that I do. I'm an avid word counter, and so I feel very strongly that the number of words that I mark down, and I keep long journals of how many words I've written per day or how many words I've edited, and I do feel like that does inspire a sort of improvement or even just a competitiveness with your past self, which is fascinating in itself.
And in this case, it's vital to survival to know how much water you're using day by day.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, when you are talking about whether you have two or four pints to be able to drink a day, that's vital.
Well, let's talk about the way that the world has caught up to your imagination. So there are cities that are now large cities like Sao Paulo and Los Angeles that are considering water rationing. And I mentioned in the introduction, Detroit and the drought that's happening in the western half of the United States and corporations that are trying to privatize water and not call it a human right. How did it feel to have all of this news catch up to you as you were writing the book? It made me think of Super Sad True Love Story by Gary Steingart, who wrote a lot of prescient things about technology and about the currency crisis with China. And shortly upon its release, they no longer seem like science fiction anymore. What was that experience like?
Yeah, I feel like Gary Steingart, really, his take on the addictiveness of personal devices was super compelling in that book. I thought that was awesome. The running grim joke that I have been talking about is that it's not a publicity stunt, just because it's absurd how many things from this book have suddenly manifested themselves this year. The drought with California is a horrible and extreme example. I don't know what percentage of your listeners know, but I mean, this is sort of off the record charts for any measurement of California that we've ever had before. And things like, you know, there's 10,000 acres of almond trees that have died, and those will never come back. And anyway, terrible stuff. The Detroit water shortages, where there is personal delivery of water, and they've cut off water to thousands of people. Of course, the poor people, or the people who are not corporations, I should say, because the corporations still have their water supplies, even though they are hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt to the Detroit Water Bureau. It's a sort of a grim pleasure seeing that, because it's like, oh, wow, that's so close to my book, but what a horrible thing to have happened. I mean, I like the idea that a novel, especially one that's sort of science fictional, I think you could call this semi-science fictional. I'm not sure how people would call it, but it's sort of a decision tree for our future, right? You can read these novels and you can decide that's not the way you want to go. Like George Orwell wrote fantastic novels, and it's integrated into our culture, into this sort of sense of the Cold War, and we're always at war with Eurasia and this sort of stuff. And that, I feel like, works as a decision tree to sort of hopefully branch us as a species away from that kind of stuff. Well, in this case, I do sort of wonder almost if my book didn't come out soon enough to help branch some of our decision making away from what's happening right now.
Well, one thing that I think really makes Sherwood Nation stand out in that regard is that it ultimately lands on a hope. It's not entirely appropriate to call it dystopian, in the sense that even though what's happened is horrible in the book, it seems to be more about putting the onus on, what do we do about it now? And the possibility of you know, crisis is an opportunity to reimagine the way we structure society.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's been a lot of wonderful signs of that recently. You and I both have talked about Dahlgren, which was by Samuel Delaney, which was an amazing book written at the tail end of the 60s revolution. And it was sort of takes place in this world where perhaps all of the thousand-year dynamics of patriarchy and corporate structure and all this stuff, what if all those sort of societal systems are just up for grabs and for reformation? And I think that is completely fascinating. And I think there have been some really interesting movements. Certainly the way that the internet works helps precipitate a lot of those movements. We look at things like the Arab Spring. We look at things like the Occupy movement. There is a lot of hope, I think, for really reworking the social order and the political order before we hit the end.
That positive note feels like a good place to end. It was great having you on Between the Covers, Ben.
Thank you very much, David.
For an opportunity to hear Ben read from his book, he will be at the Downtown Powell's next Tuesday, September 16th. We were talking today to author Ben Parzibach about his latest book, Sherwood Nation. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
You are
good morning and welcome to Between the Covers.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Tiny Home Celebration and Fundraiser on Sunday, September 14th, from 2 to 8 p.m. This celebration features a tiny home tour, opportunities to learn about tiny house living from designers, builders, and residents, a barbecue, including vegan options, and various games and entertainment. Confirmed speakers include Darren Williams, founder of ShelterWise, Dave Carboneau, co-founder of TechDwell, and tiny home movement advocate Eli Spevic. The Tiny Home Celebration and Fundraiser is at Overlook Park, located at 1301 North Fremont Street in Portland. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle Productions premiere of Tick, Tick, Boom, a play by Jonathan Larson. Tick, Tick, Boom is a 3-chapter pop rock musical about facing crossroads in life and holding on to your dreams that was first produced off-Broadway in 2001. Tick, Tick, Boom plays at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland, from September 4th through the 27th. More information about Tick, Tick, Boom can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Registration is now open for the Pacific Northwest Social Forum coming to Portland the weekend of September 26th through the 28th. The weekend will feature People's Movement assemblies on topics such as treaty rights, food sovereignty, housing justice, and more. The Social Forum will begin Friday, September 26th with the concert by KBOO Station co-manager Mike Crenshaw and friends. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this important and historic event where we, the people, will create the Pacific Northwest Plan of Action for social, economic, and climate justice. Information about registration, endorsement, childcare, or on the Pacific Northwest Social Forum in general can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.